Welcome, welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beauty Show. And I think that these days, now more than ever, we all need somebody to talk to. I don't know anyone, and I'm not just talking about my patients, but associates and friends who've not gone through a lot of ups and downs, particularly in this last year. Now, can we say that the pandemic and the virus is the cause of all of our upsets and depression and anxiety? Of course not. But certainly in the last year, everything has been exacerbated. Studies are showing that over 30% of Americans are complaining and suffering from symptoms and signs of clinical depression. 40% of people are having a really, really difficult time with a variety of different anxiety disorders. We're seeing that substance abuse rates are up, and people are still, even though if you are a pro-vaccine person, and Dr. Fauci is telling us, and I know that there are different views about the vaccine, particularly around the world, even if you're feeling safer physically, there's still a lot of angst and a lot of stress. People are concerned about their jobs, and we're still concerned about our health. And what does this mean for us long term? You know, yesterday we were walking around the streets of New York City, and I was asking myself, you know, when is there going to be a time, hopefully very, very soon, where we're going to be able to go about our lives without wearing masks, where we're going to be able to hug people and be able to go out and not have this worry, this anxiety about our physical and, of course, our mental safety as well. And social relationships, you know, prior to last March, you never would have heard me talking about the importance of spending a lot of time on social media and Zooming. And yet in the past year, my entire psychotherapy practice here in New York City and in East Hampton is on Zoom. And yes, I really, really do miss seeing my patients. And I'm one. And they're wondering, when are we going to be able to get back to business, as usual? And there's still a lot of concern about jobs. People are concerned about rent increases, basic things that the majority of people did not really give a lot of thought to. And what we are seeing, and I think it's a good thing, is that mental health helplines, they are surging. So what this is meaning is that people are really giving themselves permission to reach out and ask for help, because the loneliness, and we've been talking about a loneliness epidemic, it affects us. It affects us physically. It affects us emotionally, psychologically, and psychiatrically. When you think about asking for help, we seek outside advice for money and for legal matters, and we want to know about the best exercise regime. And yet, when it comes to our mental health, I would say that a good majority of people are still very, very reluctant to reach out and ask for help. And I'm really hoping today is the 334th ASPE show here on the Progressive Radio Network. I really hope that I have convinced you that we do not need to navigate this life on our own. We take a look at the divorce statistics, and for first marriages, divorce rate is 48%. For second marriages, that divorce rate statistic is 67%. And what happens to couples who are hoping and dreaming that their third marriages are going to work out? Well, that divorce statistic is 74%. So life is complicated enough. And, you know, if you're lucky enough to have friends, you're lucky enough to have family, you are a very, very fortunate person. But I know many people who are single and who do not have families and who do not have friends and who do not have partners. And this is why, this is the primary reason why I love to do the Ask Beattie show. And I've been doing Ask Beattie radio shows on mainstream radio now for almost 30 years. And I just think that it is so important that people know and people feel that there is someone at least once a week that you can call, that you can contact, that you can email, and that you can reach out and ask for help. And of course, the other thing that I routinely talk about are the things that we actually can do every single day, even if we're feeling a little depressed or if we're feeling anxious. And these things are things that are within our control. We can think about and put into action a good diet. We can toss away the sugars and the chocolate bars, and we can be committed to a plant-based diet, making sure that we have fruits and vegetables and grains and fish and nuts. And these are things that are within our control. We can also make sure that we are interacting as best as possible with people, even if it is on Zoom. And, you know, for those of you who've been listening to me over the past year, and I have been encouraging you to reach out to people on Zoom, the chat rooms are a great way if you are tuning in to a business talk or a health talk, and you see somebody on your Zoom call that maybe you would like to get to know, maybe you would like to connect with in some way. The chat rooms are really a great way. There's no guarantee that you're going to find the love of your life or you're going to find a good friendship, but at least you're in the game of life and you're continuing to reach out. And these are things that you can do. You can do. That's the challenge every single day. And that's the challenge every single session that I give my patients, is to make sure that we are aware of doing things that are truly in our best interest. And of course, that means socializing, and it does mean getting a good night's sleep and not staying up till all hours of the night watching Netflix and watching movies and then finding yourself waking up late in the mornings where you're tired and you're exhausted. And of course, we know the results of the studies about exercise and the importance of weight training and yoga and meditation and massage. And of course, making sure that we have supportive people in our life and eliminating toxins. Of course, Dr. Gary Null, he talks about chemical toxins all the time. And I mentioned chemical toxins, but of course, when I talk about toxicity, I refer to toxic people, which oftentimes means friends and family. And you well know that toxins, whether we're talking chemical toxins or toxic people, they really do play havoc with our lives emotionally and physically as well. And what about if you're having a tough day? What are some of the things that you can do? Well, you can lift weights. You can find yourself a comfortable place and try to visualize positive images, the sun or the beach or something that will inevitably make you feel a lot better. And music is so important. Dancing and listening to music. And some people really enjoy herbal teas that help us calm down. So again, even though you may be struggling with your life on a day-to-day basis, remember that there are things that are actually within your control that you can do that can help with your depression and can help with your anxiety. And I've often found, and I always recommend that people journal. Let's say that you don't have somebody that you can talk to, but you need an outlet to be able to express your feelings. And it's good to find yourself a quiet place and to write about how you're feeling and how you've maybe felt in the past, how you're feeling in the present. And of course, more importantly, to figure out a plan that will help you, a plan of action that will help you to be able to move forward with your life. And I was reading, and I believe it was in the New York Times, that more and more people during this past year have purchased dogs. And dogs, what a wonderful, wonderful, always loving companion and company. And we find we have Cha-Cha, which is a wonderful Havanese therapy dog. And no matter how one is feeling, I mean, you always can be assured of having a smile on your face when you have a little dog who is welcoming you, and of course, at the same time, where you're able to take care of of another being. And that too really helps people and helps all of us, certainly does help all of us with our mood and with feeling better as well. There was a piece in the New York Times about advice. And of course, I'm always giving advice to people. I'm giving advice to my patients. I'm giving advice to people who listen to me on the Progressive Radio Network. But this was a very, very interesting article. And it says, giving advice that people want to take. Be cautious when offering guidance to friends and family. And this was a piece written by a woman, Anna Goldfarb. But this is what she says. She says, a friend recently approached me in distress, saying that she wasn't sure if she should dump her boyfriend or not. And with wide, wide eyes, she asked me what I think she should do. And it gave me pause. Of course, I thought she should get rid of the guy, but I didn't want to put our relationship at risk in case she stayed with him after I shared my opinion. And expertise, it's a tricky, tricky thing. And sometimes when people don't take advice, they are rejecting the idea of being controlled by the advice giver more than anything. So we have to be very, very careful who we give advice to and how we give advice. Now, interestingly, researchers have identified three factors that determine whether input will be taken to heart. People will go along with advice. Now, listen to this. If it was costly to attain and the task is difficult, so think about lawyers interpreting a contract, advice is also more likely to be taken if the person offering counsel is more experienced and expresses extreme confidence in the quality of the advice. So think doctors recommending a treatment, for example. Emotions play a role too. Decision makers are more likely to disregard advice if they feel certain they've already made up their minds about what they're going to do. For example, staying in a toxic relationship, no matter what the friend or friends or family is advising. So here are some other things to keep in mind to make sure that the advice that you give in others will land you in a good place. And again, I have to caution you that you have to be very, very careful to whom and how you give advice. So, for example, the first thing that I recommend is evaluate the situation, making sure that you're actually being asked to give counsel, because it's easy to confuse being audience to a venting session with someone that is just asked to weigh in, because sometimes people just want to feel heard and they really don't want your good advice, regardless of how well-intentioned you are. It's almost like people will say to you, I want a strategy, And what they really mean is just, I want someone to understand what it is that I am going through. So would you be willing to hear some of my ideas is a really good way to start a conversation? Or do you just want me to listen? Because this balances the playing field. So you have to be prepared for the person to decline your lovely offer, and the person just might be saying, no, I'm not interested. I'm not interested in advice, but all I need to do right now is vent. And then you have to be clear on the goals, because when people approach others for advice, you want to know exactly, specifically, what you can do to help. So, for example, you may repeat back what you heard to be sure that you've grasped the heart of the issue, and to ask, what kind of outcome do you want from my advice? Okay, so that you're asking people, you're not just giving them advice, but you're wanting to make sure that you understand what it is that they are want, so that you are not crossing over certain boundary lines that will inevitably, and they do, they get us into a lot of trouble. You have to also consider the expertise. People often go to those close to them for advice, even if the family members and friends aren't always in the best position to effectively to assist. So that if you are wanting expert advice about a really complicated issue, your friends and your family, they may want very, very much to help you, and they may be weighing in all kinds of ways, but that may not at all be the best advice for you to take. So the key is to put your loved ones' needs and interests front and center. And it's okay for you to say, look, I don't feel equipped to be able to give you advice on this particular subject. And that is a really important thing for all of us to be able to acknowledge to ourselves and to acknowledge to others, that we simply don't know. This is not our area of expertise. But if you are going to be giving advice, you want to be friendly, you don't want to be preachy. And I think it's also really important to be able to share your experience, because people tend to resist when advice is preachy. And to be able to say something like, you know, I've been through something very similar, and this may not be your experience, but this is the strategy. This is how I handled this particular situation. This may not be for you the way I handled this, but in fact, I just want to share my experience with you. And of course, just offering support as needed. You know, I'm sorry that you're having a really, really difficult time, and I'm always happy to listen. But in the final analysis, if you are needing more expert advice, you know, I would suggest perhaps that you see a therapist, or you talk to somebody who has much more experience in this particular area than I do. You're being honest, you're being loving, you're being empathic, and you are being truthful, and you are not going to get yourself into a lot of hot water. And talking about advice, I received an email from a woman named Veronica a couple of days ago. And this is what she says. She says, "Dear Beatty, I have been married for 10 years. My husband has had an alcohol problem for most of his life. And when we married, he promised me, and he promised his children from another marriage, that he was going to get help, and that he was going to really, really be serious about working on his addiction. And he never, ever has. I have begged, I have pleaded, I'm worried about his physical health, but there is absolutely nothing that I have been able to say thus far that has made any difference in his behavior. He will go for a couple of weeks without drinking, and then he's back to business as usual. What should I do? Well, Veronica, I mean, this is a really tough situation, and this isn't about blaming. I mean, when you married him, you knew he had an alcohol problem, and of course, you wanted to trust, you wanted to believe that he was going to follow through, on his promises. And as I've been saying for years and years and years, and this was something that a professor of mine at McGill University taught me. He taught me that we can't want it more for others than they want for themselves, and that we can't change anybody. We can't change anybody's experiences. We can't change anybody's behavior. And all we can actually do is be encouraging. So the ball is really in your court. What do you want to do? I know that you say that you love him, but he's very clear that he doesn't want to change. He doesn't want to take responsibility for his drinking problem. So the real question is, what are you going to do? And if you continue to just, complain and be upset, I mean, you're just part of a certain dynamic. That's really the deal. He's going to do nothing, and you are going to complain and be upset. Seems like you've tried to be encouraging, and you're trying to be supportive. But it looks like after 10 years that he has absolutely no intention at all of making any changes. So the real question is, what are you going to do knowing the reality of your situation? It's no longer a question of assessing. He is an alcoholic, and he has told you. He has told you by his behavior that he does not want to change. And last week, I actually had a couple of experiences like this with two of my patients. One woman told me that yes, she's single and she's depressed, and she would ideally like to have a partner, but she said to me very, very clearly, she said, "At this point in my life, Beatie, I am not prepared to do anything at all." And one can motivate, one can try to inspire somebody to stay in the game of life, but in the final analysis, people have to make decisions about how they choose to live their lives. And this woman decided to not continue in therapy with me. And we had had a few sessions, but she was very clear. She said, "I will not do anything differently." So there was really nothing else that I could say other than if she changed her mind and wanted to be motivated and inspired, and maybe give herself an opportunity to have a better next chapter in life than she's had previously, that she should give me a call. And I was really disappointed because I was hoping that we would become a really viable team, and that her life, I mean, that was really the bottom line why she called, that her life, her quality of life would improve. But if somebody says, "I don't want to do the work, I don't want to do anything," then there is nothing one can do. And all the good advice and all the probing and all the begging is typically not going to work. So, Veronica, I hope you're going to let me know what happens and what you decide to do, because you've been looking to see whether he is willing to make some changes. And he's told you over and over again that he is not willing to do anything. So either you are going to choose to stay and remain in the marriage, living with an alcoholic and being on a roller coaster ride, or perhaps you may decide to look at some other options. And I really do wish you the best. There was a wonderful and an uplifting piece that I read in the New York Times in the vow section, looking to see who is getting married. And this was the headline: for some seniors, time to lock down on romance. And I love this first paragraph. When 91-year-old Sam Gallo and 86-year-old Millie Hawthorne got engaged in March 2020. I mean, that is incredible. And what the studies have actually been showing, and I thought this was interesting, and of course, it really makes a lot of sense, is that companionship is often found in long-term care facilities. Now, listen, we don't have to wait to go into a long-term care facility in order to find companionship and in order to find love. But research published, this is interesting, in the Sexuality Research and Social Policy in 2009, found that it was common for assisted living residents to have a continued interest in romantic relationships. And while intercourse isn't unheard of, as in assisted living, the findings overwhelmingly revealed that intimate touch, hand-holding, and other less physically intense expressions were common. So we're seeing more and more relationship building, some romantic, some friendship, says a Daniel Reingold, who is the president and chief executive of the Hebrew Home at Riverdale in the Bronx. What I'm sensing is not that there's an increased fear of mortality so much that there's an increased appreciation for love. And I think that that should give us a lot of hope. So there were a number of couples that were cited in this particular article in their 80s and in their 90s who were romantically involved, who were engaged, and who actually got married. So that should give all of us who are much younger hope that it is actually never too late and you're never too old to find companionship and romantic love. And even if it is not romantic love, at least you have companionship and a connection, which is something that we all desperately, desperately need if we're going to be able to live a really good and joyful life. Well, now we're going to move into a very heavy, heavy topic. And I don't know how many of you have been following the Woody Allen and Dylan Farrow, Mira Farrow saga that has been going on for years and years. And I want to give you some statistics about early child sexual abuse. And these are statistics that are very painful. They're very painful to talk about, but there is a reality that we have to know about and we have to acknowledge. And you may not know that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys are sexually abused before they turn 18. Over 65,000 children were sexually abused in the year 2016. 34% of people who sexually abuse a child are family members. So these are not typically strangers. 12.3% of girls were age 10 or younger. 12.3% of little girls age 10 or younger at the time of their first victimization. 30% of girls were between the ages of 11 and 17. 27.8% of boys were 10 or younger at the time of their first victimization. And 96% of people who abuse children are male. And 76% of abusers are adults. And listen to this. Every 73 seconds, an American is sexually assaulted, and every nine minutes, that victim is a child, and only 5 out of every 1,000 perpetrators will end up in prison. Before I introduce my guest, I just want to give you a little bit of background here. The Allen versus Farrow is a docuseries. It concerns what happened to Dylan Farrow, a 7-year-old girl, and her decision to talk about her alleged sexual abuse decades later. She says, "It has taken me a long time to reconcile that you can really love somebody and be afraid of them as well," Dylan Farrow states at the beginning, and how cathartic it is to see her ready to talk about something that we've all wanted to know about for years and years. But this is her story, and that of her mother, Mia Farrow, and Dylan's family of biological and adopted siblings, told not through the filter of warfare. Instead, it is a thoroughly investigative and empathic perspective, one that collects a slew of first-person accounts and retraces the cases. We're talking about Woody Allen, retraces the case's evolution in an imbalanced public scandal and educates viewers about the real experiences of living with abuse. So my guest today, and this is very convenient, is my husband, sociologist Jim Bredos. He is a former professor at Yeshiva University and John Jay College, and host of the really terrific, and you really got to tune in and watch the show. It plays multiple times during the week in Brooklyn and Queens and in New York and all the boroughs. The show is called The Radical Imagination. And Jim, I know that we have been watching the show together. Last night was the second episode, and of course it has to do with the alleged allegations against Woody Allen and Dylan Farrow. This is what she is saying, and there are videotapes that concur her allegations that Dylan was 7 years old, and it was the summer of 1992 when she alleges that Woody Allen sexually abused her in the attic. And by the way, I just want you to know that the directors of Allen versus Farrow is Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering. And so what we're doing right now is we're wanting to have a very honest and balanced discussion. Thus far, we've only seen the two episodes of Dylan Farrow's perspective and her family and her siblings and friends about what they witnessed and what she says that she had to deal with as a little girl growing up. So I'm really happy that you are here and in my office. So it makes it very easy that we didn't have to go into a studio. So seriously, Jim, as a sociologist, what are you making thus far of Allen versus Farrow, the docuseries?
Well, first of all, thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here as always. And boy, listening to your startling statistics leading up to this discussion, they're just mind-blowing. And we are attempting to deal with some really, really profound issues here. And I know we've been looking forward to and have been watching this series, this docuseries, with hopes that this will be a really enlightening experience for the country and for a culture that is really trying to understand very, very carefully now the profound hurts that we are experiencing, particularly, as you point out, women and young children and so on. I would have to say, just to start our discussion today, that I would look forward to a much more balanced program in which you would have the other side, Alan's side, heard from, the different therapists on both sides being asked to speak and to have discussion, bring in some of the lawyers, the judges. And so perhaps that will happen in the third and fourth episode. I don't know, but I'm not really planning on that happening, because I think, as you pointed out, these directors have literally been hired to construct a work, a very well done creative work, but it is, again, from the perspective of the Farrell.
And we need to make it very, very clear that, you know, Woody Allen was never convicted of, you know, of anything. Right. And I mean, this has been going on for years and years. There were so many different court hearings. Right. And yet in listening to last night's show, to me, right, it was so interesting how the therapists and how police and judges and lawyers, I mean, things became convoluted during the process. And when I heard, and I think that everybody, if you're interested in this subject at all, and I think that we should all have an interest in what is really going on in our society, the good, the bad, the ugly, there was a videotape that Mia Farrow made of little 7-year-old Dylan, where Dylan described very, very clearly. Mia was asking the questions. She was asking the exact same questions that I have asked hundreds of people who I have treated for early child sexual abuse. They weren't leading questions. They were very specific questions. And to watch Dylan Farrell answer the questions about what she says that Woody Allen did to her, it was extremely painful for me to watch. And in my mind, I mean, maybe over the years, I have missed something when it comes to patients' allegations, but I have yet, after treating hundreds of survivors of early child sexual abuse, to my knowledge, I have yet to meet anybody who lied about what did and did not happen. And it was that videotape last night that really convinced me that indeed this little girl certainly appeared to have been sexually abused. It was the video. It wasn't the talk about his movies. It wasn't the talk about the fact in his movies he often portrayed older men and younger women. None of that for me, Jim, was relevant. But it was listening to this little 7-year-old girl talk about what she says Woody Allen did to her.
No,
and that he touched my private parts. And she was very specific about what that meant.
No, understood. But that, again, that took up, what, about 2 or 3 minutes of a
That's true.
2-hour production so far.
That's true.
And I would have loved to, again, if they were really serious about this and educating the public and getting it, the truth in this, is to have more clinicians like yourself comment on this and give the American public an idea of what are some of the signs they should be looking for within their own family and what was going on in this incredible family structure that is being presented here. But so far, that hasn't happened.
Well, but what Dylan was saying, and that was certainly, it was portrayed in the first episode. She says, I was always in his clutches. And we watched the videos. Mm-hmm. She was always in his clutches. He was always having me. She talked about cuddling in bed with Alan while both of them were in there in their underwear. And when you talk about signs and symptoms, I mean, as parents, if we notice, and it may not be sexual abuse, but if we notice that something is off, that our child seems to be maybe, you know, depressed, or there's been a change in behavior or mood, or anxious or withdrawn, or whether or not there may be nightmares or bedwetting. And in this particular docuseries, we had videos showing Dylan with her brother, Ronan Farrow, that she didn't want, when Woody Allen would come to visit her, that she didn't want to go and spend time with him. Now, Mia Farrow, she had a lot of children, so she was busy, you know, regardless of the fact that, you know, she had a lot of help. But this would be a sign as a mother. Why all of a sudden does my child not want to spend time with her father or with her stepfather? Of course, he adopted her.
Right. Well, as you were saying, there are so many, as you were saying, certain symptoms, bedwetting, etc., could be indications of something else happening, not necessarily sexual abuse.
Absolutely.
So again, as we try to get more specific here.
Absolutely.
I know this is very... Or imperfect science, I guess, trying to get to know more and more.
Very imperfect.
Very imperfect. And,
yes.
And so when you say, well, gee, a particular child is finding it difficult to be with a parent or is annoyed. I mean, there could be a lot of things going on.
But to be investigated, to find, when I say investigated, I'm not talking about the police.
Well, what some family members might tolerate more of that than others.
But I think it's a conversation that you would want to have with your child. Why don't you want to go with daddy? Why don't you want to spend time with daddy?
Right.
And if there is concern, now Mia Farrow was very concerned that he was completely obsessed with this little girl right from the beginning. And I know that he was in therapy and she was in therapy and the little girl was in therapy. But when we looked at that video last night, I mean, any therapist, any pediatrician who would have watched that video would have taken some action. And yet they didn't, apparently.
Well, you know, you use the term obsessed. I mean, it's a general term. How does one become more precise as one, you know, tries to use that term in a specific relationship between a child and parent? And also, you've got to take into consideration again, right? Age, other things that might be happening in the person's, in the child's life.
But she said it. She said, I was always, now she's saying this as a 35-year-old, but she says, I was always in his clutches. He was always hunting me.
Those are interesting choices of terms by a 7-year-old. Clutches, hunting.
She said when she was seven. She is saying that now. And the thing that people have to know, though, Jim, is that when Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering, who were the directors of Allen versus Farrow, they initially approached Dylan and Mia Farrow, they were not eager at all to participate. It took Dylan in something I had read about a month to decide, and it took Mia about 10 months to finally agree. I mean, this is something.
Why do you think they agreed? I'm just curious.
Dylan needs to have her story told in a way that it has never been.
That's what
been.
She said.
That is exactly. And she said, and this is a quote, she said, if we don't speak about these things, no one will ever know the truth.
Do you think this is the forum for her to have done this? Or could it have been done, for example, as I said before, with but certainly showing the tape and comments by experts like yourself, clinicians, and have a back and forth on that. Would that have been something that might have been more helpful for her and for the general public?
I think that the primary consideration for this docuseries is for her to continue to try to heal.
Okay.
And, you know, what people think or don't think, and, you know, whoever happened to be, you know, Woody Allen fans, and we've certainly been Woody Allen fans, you know, for his amazing movies that he's made over the years. This young woman who is now 35, who is married, who is a mother, she needed and needs to be heard to tell a story that apparently, and I don't even understand how this is possible, Jim, that this story and that this video, which for me clinically is
the first time
so
this was
clear.
Heard, saw it, seen, right? But let me just say, back up just for one second. It would be I would love to hear her statement now that this is out there, or after the third and fourth part. I'd love to hear a statement about, hey, this is, thank you, America, whatever. Thank you, America, for watching, listening. This has been a difficult position, a difficult experience, but I thank you for helping me get more healed on this.
I hope that is going to happen.
Then that would be more, that would answer your question as to whether or not this has been a successful way for her to deal with. Well, all this, and whether her own therapist and other people advise her to do it this way. But in any case, perhaps we'll see as time goes by. But yeah, you were raising something else very, very interesting.
Well, the thing that really surprises me, although I have to tell you that as a psychotherapist and sex therapist, nothing surprises me what goes on and doesn't go on in the world of American mental health. And that is, you know, when we were going through some of the material to prepare for the show, there were social workers and there were two social workers, and there was a doctor, I think he was a psychologist or a psychiatrist, who apparently, in quotes, from Yale, who signed off on this particular case without ever having examined Dylan. I don't understand how that was possible. And notes were destroyed. And what was that all about? Was that about notoriety? Was that the lawyers, that the lawyers were the ones that were really running this entire case, as so often happens?
And what about, as you point out, the most important part of this is that tape of her? Why? This is evidently the first time it's been shown publicly. One would assume, we were talking about this before, that some judge has seen it, right? I mean, or what do you think?
My understanding in reviewing some of the documents is that the judge did see the tape, and made a decision to not put her on the stand. Now, I have worked with many, many young children. You're not going to put them on the stand. You're going to have a psychiatrist. You're going to have a psychologist whose area of expertise is early child sexual abuse. You take them into a room. It can be recorded. It can be done kinds of ways to be able to get the child's statement,
and she's protected,
and
as
she's
much as
protected
possible, right from
and it. Yet the rationale, from what I gather thus far, is that the judge made a decision that he didn't want to put her on the stand, and as a result the case was basically tossed out.
And there's so many other things to point out here. Why weren't the police brought in at first? The other thing that may have mentioned too, that she wanted to mention this right after all this happened to her, to the therapist. And I know we're in New York here, and August is New Year's therapist vacation time, but she said it was gone the whole summer. I mean, come on.
But even if the therapist, and that is what she said, she said that the
therapist. Some therapist, right?
Somebody,
exactly.
Exactly. But one of the things, because I certainly don't want to cast any blame on Mia or on any parent that would be dealing with this kind of trauma. Right. I mean, you're not exactly an expert. And when you're traumatized yourself, you know, oftentimes you're not going to be thinking, you know, very well. But clearly, after having heard what little Dylan Farrow, 7 years of age at the time, had to say, I mean, ideally, the first thing would have been to take her to a doctor, to her pediatrician, to be examined. And then, of course, the doctors and therapists, I mean, we have legal responsibilities. You can't slough off this kind of a thing to report to the proper authorities. So again, it's my understanding in reviewing these documents that this did not happen after Mia took the videotape of Dylan's allegations as a little girl.
How can you help your audience? People who are listening to you today, some who have kids, who have nephews, whatever.
Yes. Nieces,
what would you say to these people who perhaps are watching the show or not watching it? What are some of the things you would like the audience to take away from all this?
If you have concerns, you know, whether or not it is early child sexual abuse concerns or eating disorder concerns or concerns of any kind, whether it's depression, anxiety, substance abuse of various different kinds, if you have concerns about your child, okay, you're a parent, you love your child. Most of us wouldn't have had the kind of expertise to know exactly what to do. You seek out a professional who does have the expertise, whether it's a therapist, whether it's a pediatrician who at least would physically examine a child. And then if there was concerns about depression, anxiety, abuse of various different kinds, then a referral would need to be made to somebody who specialized in the particular disorder.
But do you have a conversation with your child?
Absolutely.
And what are some of the or perhaps if there are, you know, possible accusations that are occurring with, let's say, your partner or spouse or whoever might be accused. I mean, these gets into delicate.
Very issues, delicate.
But first, you have to have that conversation with your child. How does that go?
You know, I had a patient, and I know that the time is going, and this is such an important subject. I had a patient a number of years ago, and all of a sudden, she decided that she did not want to drive in a car with her stepfather. Mm. And then she just seemingly, you know, out of nowhere, abruptly decided to lock her door. And I was discussing this with the mother, who did everything possible to talk to the daughter about why she no longer wanted to drive in the car and why all of a sudden, she locked her door. The girl would not discuss it. She said this was a subject that was absolutely off limits. Now, what this mother did do, which was fantastic, is that despite the fact that the girl did not want to talk to the parent, the mother took the daughter to me.
See.
And through our therapeutic relationship.
How old was she now? How old was the daughter?
She was 10.
10. Okay.
Yes. And the mother tried. And the mother was a guidance counselor. And she knew how to deal with kids.
Right.
And she tried and she tried and she tried. And the daughter was adamant.
Mm-hmm.
So even though the daughter had no desire in the world to talk to the mother and no desire in the world to go and talk to a therapist, the mother did exactly the right thing and took the daughter to see me. And initially, the daughter had no desire to talk to me about anything. She would just kind of sit there and was like, okay, the time is going. And finally, it came out.
When does the conversation with the stepfather come in?
Well, as soon as the daughter was able to finally disclose what happened
within the therapy,
then the mother was able to confront the stepfather, right. And then the case went further. And then, it was a very complicated kind of an issue. Right. The stepfather absolutely categorically denied that anything happened,
right.
And it always becomes. He said, she said situation.
Right.
You know, I would really like Jim to be able to talk much, much more about this issue and this dynamic. It is so important. The statistics are daunting.
There's three and four, there's third and fourth issue. I mean,
exactly.
So we can come back and discuss some more.
I think that is exactly, exactly what we should do. So listen, everybody, it is 3:56. I don't know where the time goes on the Ask Beatty Show. Oh, but listen, I want to thank you all so much about listening and emailing me and sending me all kinds of letters about your issues. And I will try to take up as many of them, during the show as I possibly can. And I want to leave you with my two weekly messages, which is number one, to do everything that you can possibly do every day, even if you're not feeling great, to do what is in your best interest. And of course, we all need to do a much, much, much better job in learning to love each other. So have a good rest of the day. And my favorite Ask Beatty song every week is, what the world needs now is love, sweet love. So love yourselves and love each other. And I will talk with you next week. So goodbye, everybody. Take good care.
Amen.